Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. This is a show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our featured guest on today's Bookmark is Geoffrey Archer, talking about his new novel, Turn a Blind Eye. We'll also hear from crime writers Sid Moore and Mick Finlay, discussing how they use real history in their work. And Helen Scales talks about her new book, The Brilliant Abyss, which is about the deep sea. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Geoffrey.
Thank you.
We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But as I say, this is a show with a local slant, and you are a well-known resident of Grantchester in Cambridgeshire. How long have you lived there now?
It's quite an interesting story in the fact that I was penniless and sold a book called Cain and Abel to the Americans. And overnight, I became a multimillionaire. And with the first check that came through, we purchased the old vicarage, Grantchester. And the answer to your question is over 40 years ago.
So you obviously still love it there.
Oh, we love Cambridge. We love Grantchester. We couldn't have a more beautiful home.
And it's also a home that's associated with the poet Rupert Brooke. That must be very inspiring for you as a writer as well.
Yes, indeed. And we've built a statue, which we've placed in the front right by the gate so everyone can see it and remember that the great man lived here.
And we're going to hear your first choice of music in just a moment. Is music important to you?
Not in the way it is to my wife. I'm a bit of a pleb. I'm a bit of a normal human being. I mean, I like Frank Sinatra. I like Ella Fitzgerald. My wife would happily listen to Wagner all day. It's one of our many differences. So yes, I do love music, but I can't pretend to be a patrician.
And this track, this is a lovely track that we're starting with now. This is A Better Place to Be by Harry Chapin.
Oh, this is a piece of genius. This was given to me as a gift 40 years ago. I'd never heard of him, knew nothing about him. And we won't be able to play the whole of it, which is sad. So I hope you've chosen very carefully, because I say to anyone listening to this, listen to the whole piece. It's the most beautiful piece of storytelling.
It was an early morning barroom, and the place just opened up. And a little man come in so fast and started at his cups. And the broader served the whiskey. She was a big old friendly girl, and she tried to fight her empty nights by smiling at the world. And she said, "Hey, Bob, it's been a while since you've been around me."
That was A Better Place to Be by Harry Chapin, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our featured guest, Geoffrey Archer. Geoffrey's first novel, Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, was published in 1975. Since then, he's written another 34 books and in total has sold over 275 million copies of his work around the world. Turn a Blind Eye is the third instalment in the William Warwick series, focusing on the family man and detective tasked with exposing corruption at the heart of the Metropolitan Police Force. Well, Geoffrey, that is quite a list of achievements there. 34 books. Does that mean, after that many books, that much writing, that the process is easier for you?
No, it never gets easier. The pressure at one level is very different when you're 80 as to when I began in my 30s. In my 30s, I was expectant, hopeful, determined. Now it's the fear of not being as good. And one knows only too well how many authors have tailed off or not delivered. And ironically, you are the first person I've spoken to since the early reviews for this book have come in. I'm almost in tears this morning. The reviews are so generous. So as long as they are, as long as the reviewers are that way, and the book, as you know, went to number one in 20 minutes. So as long as that goes on, the answer to your question is, I will go on. If I felt the public no longer were enjoying William Warwick and his exploits, and Turn a Blind Eye wasn't, they felt, up to the standard of the early books, I'd stop. I'm 80 years old, full of enthusiasm, full of energy, loving every minute of the writing. And I hope it'll never stop. I consider myself a very lucky human being to have a simple gift. I'm not a countertenor. I can't play the violin. I'm not a ballet dancer. I tell a simple story. And that, frankly, is a God-given gift. And I'm very, very lucky. I work hard. And I say to all aspiring authors, I don't give a damn how good you are. If you don't work hard, you won't get anywhere. But don't kid yourself. You can be a writer if you're well-educated, well-read, but a storytellers are born.
And what makes a good storyteller? Because you have been described as one of the greatest storytellers of the age. What makes a good storyteller?
I think if you want to turn the page, if you want to find out what's happening next, that's the simple answer. I have people, I mean, there's a lady who's written today saying she's read the book already. It's only been out 8 hours. And she said, when is the next one coming? As if one can deliver it by this afternoon. I take 1,000 hours to write a book. I do 14 drafts. Every draft is handwritten. And I've had to write back to her and say, hold on. So the fans are absolutely wonderful. God bless them. They're mad, of course, but I love them.
And has your writing changed over the years? When you look back at Cain and Abel, do you write in a different way now?
That's a very good point. I think I'm a better craftsman. There's a fan club for Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, my first book. 20 to 25% of my fans think that's the best thing I've ever done. A vast majority think Cain and Abel is. But what it shows to me is that was the third book, that the storytelling was always there to answer your question. I think I'm a better craftsman. I think after nearly 40 years, I know how to do the plot in a certain way. And of course, when I get up each morning and go to my desk, I've done that before. So yes, I don't think I'm a better storyteller. I think I'm a better craftsman.
And you like a series as well. We've Cain and Abel, the Clifton Chronicles, and now the William Warwick series. What is it about a series that appeals to you as a writer?
Well, I set off with the Clifton Chronicles, with Harry Clifton in Bristol, born in the back streets, wins a place at Bristol Grammar School, goes on to Oxford, and becomes an author. So I was clearly writing about myself. But the answer to your question is I'd set out to write three books. I was 70 years old, and I thought, I'll write three books. I'll write this trilogy. And I got to the third book, and Emma was only 30, and Harry was only 30, and their dear friend Giles was only 32. So I decided, well, it's going to be at least five books. So I went back to the publisher and said, how do you feel? Well, it was number one right across the world at the time, so they weren't complaining. So I did five books, and I went back to them and said, I haven't finished. I know I can finish in two more books. So I did seven books in the end, ending on This Was a Man. What I like to do, to answer your question, is something totally different. Write a play, but often it's short stories. I love writing short stories. I've done 92 short stories, six books of short stories. They're not as popular throughout the world for anybody. I mean, the days of H.H. Munro, Scott Fitzgerald, De Maupassant are behind us in the sense that you could dominate publishing with a great set of short stories. You can't do that any longer. But it doesn't stop me answering your question, loving it and wanting to do it. Now, I've had a big problem this year. I've been locked up very pleasantly in Cambridge. So I haven't met human beings. And I get most of my good stories, short stories, from human beings who tell me the most outrageous things that have happened in their life. They very rarely would make a novel, but they often made a damn good short story. But being closed down for a year, one of the many things I've missed is the intermingling with people. I've, of course, missed doing my charity auctions that I love. I've missed the theater. I've missed general socializing, and heaven knows, I hope it won't be too much longer. But I'm in a very privileged position. Let me explain. I have a friend who has an art gallery. He's had a terrible year. I've had a friend who owns a restaurant. He's had a terrible year. I would normally write one book in a year in the William Warwick series. I've written two this year because I've been locked down. So my normal method of writing from 6 to 8, 10 to 12, 2 to 4, 6 to 8, bed at 9:30, 10, up at 5:30, hasn't stopped. It's just gone on and on. Whereas normally I would break and go to the theater. Mary and I would go abroad on holiday. We would meet people where I get my stories. That hasn't been happening. But I can't complain. Because during lockdown, I've written two novels.
And how do you research, Geoffrey? Because there's a lot about police procedural in this novel. Yes. It's a lot about drugs as well. How do you research all that?
Yes. The truth is people. I do a lot of reading, but I never quite get the feel with reading. So on this book, Turn a Blind Eye, and indeed in the first, right from the beginning with Nothing Ventured, I made this big decision that people are more important than reading. So I read, and then got people. And I came across a man called Chief Superintendent John Sutherland when he was at the House of Commons, House of Lords Advent Carol service, and he was reading the lesson. And I read his biography. He'd left the Metropolitan Police in what he described in his brilliant book as one murder too many. He had a mental breakdown. I went to see him. I said, would you be my chief researcher? Would you make sure I don't make a fool of myself? Check the book and see mistakes. He said, I can't, Geoffrey. I haven't fully recovered. I can't even read a detective novel. I knew I wasn't starting the William Warwick series until another year. So I asked him a year later and he said, yes, I think I could face it now. So he became my chief researcher, and my second researcher, but equally powerful, was Detective Sergeant Michel Roycroft, 30 years in the drug squad and the murder squad. What a tough lady. So the combination of those two, when they get the book, I say, if I've made a fool of myself, just put a note in the side, you can't do this, you can do that, you can't do the other. And occasionally, of course, they came up with little gems themselves about their lives. For example, Michelle, very attractive woman. I said, what was it like when you were first a young policewoman? He said, oh, well, I got in a lot of trouble quite early on because an inspector put his hand on my leg and I knocked him out. It didn't help my career, she said. And John, I've got this deeply committed Christian, honest, decent man, who I suppose in a way William Warwick is based on. So the answer to your question is the two of them keep me honest.
And we're just about to hear from Sid Moore and Mick Finlay about basing fiction on real life. So it seems that you use real life so much in your work, the experiences of people and maybe particular cases.
Yes, indeed. Each book, as you know, has a different subject. The first one is art fraud. The second one is drugs. The third one, Turn a Blind Eye, which has just come out, is police corruption. And in each case, John Sutherland, because he knows everybody in the Metropolitan Police, has said, I'll bring in the expert on the drugs one, to give you an example. He brought in this amazing man who'd been head of the drug squad and recently retired. And he told me simple facts like 5 million people are on marijuana, 500,000 people are on crack cocaine, 250,000 people are on heroin. And so I got the facts right all through the book, because you've got to get the facts right. The reader's got to say, this sounds right. I like the story, but the facts sound right. But I said to him one day, you're pathetic. You're useless. He said, what do you mean, Geoffrey? I'm useless. I said, well, I know everything now about drugs, but you haven't given me a story yet. You haven't told me one story, you pathetic worm. I mean, there must be in that brain of yours the most amazing. Oh, no. And John Sutherland said he's not very good at stories, Geoffrey. He doesn't understand. And we were walking out of the room and I said, what's the thing that's most annoyed you? And he said, well, there was a burglar once. I knew who he was. And what made it worse, he said, on my birthday, he used to send a Harrods hamper to Scotland Yard, wishing me a happy birthday. And he said, we used to open it on the main desk in front of everybody. And everything I liked was in that hamper. But of course, I had to hand it in. I took him by the throat. I got quite near to killing him. I said, that is a story. That is wonderful stuff. And indeed, in the second book, it's the first five pages is a hamper on the middle of the table with Commander Hawksby and William Warwick opening it, realizing they can't take anything out. So sometimes they give me a little gem like that, which the public, of course, will know is true. It's far-fetched, but the public will know, oh, yes, I believe that, Geoffrey. You've got that from a detective. I believe it. And they will also know that my figures on the drug taking are true. So the answer to your question is I tried desperately to put the two together, to tell a story, but at the same time, drop in without plonking facts so that people go, oh, my God, 250,000 people on heroin.
Thank you, Geoffrey. Well, let's hear now from Sid Moore and Mick Finlay. Mick Finlay's first novel, Arrowwood, was published in 2017, and there have been two more since then, The Murder Pit and Arrowwood and the Thames Corpses, all featuring the eponymous detective and set in Victorian London. Sid Moore is the author of the Essex Witch Museum series of books. There have been four in the series so far, with Rosie Strange, curator of the museum, as the heroine. Sid and Mick recently spoke together at the Cambridge Festival about basing fiction on real life. I grabbed them beforehand for a quick chat on the same subject and asked them what had inspired their work.
The subject which drew me in was the witch hunt in Leon C, where I live. There's a pub called the Sarah Moore. Obviously, because my surname is Moore, I wanted to know who Sarah Moore was, and I found out that she was meant to be a sea witch who used to give blessings to sailors for a penny, but would also sell a wind spell, which is something where you knot in the wind. And I was absolutely fascinated by it when I found out about it, so I started investigating it. I googled Essex witches and I didn't find out anything about Sarah Moore, but I did find out this statistic which completely floored me, and it was that between 1560 and 80 in Hertford, Surrey and Sussex, there were 185 indictments for theft. In Essex on its own, over the same period of time, there were 503. So huge difference. And as I sort of excavated that, I came across Matthew Hopkins, who I know came up your way as well, and his massive witch hunt, and lots of other different witch hunts, and lots of other unfortunate women and some men who had been taken to trial, some of them who hadn't even made it as far as trial, who'd died before that. As I researched, I found out that on just one day in July 1649, 29 women had been tried and 19 of them had been hanged on that one day. One of the things which shocked me was that I didn't know any of the women's names. So I kind of made it my mission to really look into some of their stories.
What about you, Mick? Why did you end up in Victorian London?
I was reading Sherlock Holmes's stories, and it occurred to me that had I been a private detective in London at the same time as Sherlock Holmes, I probably would not have been too keen on him, probably insanely jealous with all the fame and fortune and how brilliant everybody thought he was. You know, if you look into the history books, there were plenty of private detectives working in London, in Victorian London. And I just had an idea for a character. So what happens if I put a private detective in London and he's competing against Sherlock Holmes? And it had to be a completely opposite type of detective. So he couldn't be cold. He had to be over-emotional. He couldn't be fit and good at fighting. He had to be unhealthy and bad at fighting and a bit of a coward. And so when I started to look into the history of Victorian London, I realized that Sherlock Holmes's cases really didn't deal with the big issues of the day at all. Jack the Ripper was around. There's no mention of that. Mental health and illness isn't treated seriously. Home rule for Ireland and the bombing campaigns in London, again, not treated. So there was a whole treasure trove of potential stories this character could deal with.
So when you found out all that, did you feel some sort of moral obligation to tell that story truthfully? I mean, how much wriggle room do you give yourself when you're setting a specific time period and playing with big issues? What needs to be accurate and what doesn't?
I think as much as possible should be accurate, but you are writing fiction. I've got a book coming out in July, which is, it's inspired by a real story when five Zulus are taken into a London magistrate's court and charged with refusing to perform as Africans in one of those ethnic exhibitions.
Wow.
Took that as my starting point. But I had to invent then a crime, because it's a crime novel. But that crime is based on another true story, which is there was a gang in South Africa called the Ninevites, who were like a bandit gang. And they were like the most obvious sign of rebellion against white rule in South Africa. The backstory involved this true Ninevite gang, which were operating at the time. So I like to use as much proper detail and make the context as realistic as possible.
What about you, Sid? It sounds like you felt some sort of personal responsibility to these women.
Yeah, it's a bit of a crusade, I would say, actually. If I go back to Sarah Moore, so her reputation in Lee is that of this old, haggard sea witch. But when I started to research her, I found out that she basically just had a really tough life. So her first husband had been lost at sea, and he'd been a widower. So she had children from him, and she had her own children. And then she got married again to another widower, gathered more children. They had more children. He died. And the first thing I found her on was the 1851 census. At that point, she had 9 children and she'd lost 6. She was the head of the household and she put her occupation down as mangler. So one of the things I have to do when I'm talking to school children is actually show them a picture of a mangle, telling them that it was actually really backbreaking work doing that. So she probably did look quite bent over. And also she's well known for her witch's sack. But was it a witch's sack or was it laundry that she was ferrying around from place to place? Around the time that she lost her second husband, this is when she became, in inverted commas, magically able. And I think you have to put that in the context of the fact that there was no welfare state at that point. And if you had lots of hungry children to feed, you did what you could to raise the money. So she would also sell potions and herbal cures. I think her reputation might have been of what we'd call today a white witch. So I wasn't sure how I was going to approach it. And then I kind of found myself going into the time slip and ghost story genre. So the main character starts to think she's being haunted. And then she experiences these time slip mind melds with the old Sarah Moore, which enabled me to get into the head of someone who was living at that time. It's always really important for me to find out as much as I can about the trials, especially when I'm dealing with witch legends, because so many times I find out that it's completely inaccurate.
For you, Mick, more recent history is still a long way back, but it's more recent history. You can walk the streets that your characters would have walked.
Yeah, I do a lot of that, actually. I mean, it's interesting that part of London, South London, around Waterloo and London Bridge is where the characters live. And it's changing so fast. You can go there and there'll be a Victorian building there, and then you'll go back 6 months later and it's disappeared. You still find pockets, and there's a few old coaching inns, and you can find pubs that were there back then and are still there. There's lots of, if you could walk along the Thames Path, there's so many bits that are there. I mean, they're not whole bits, but they're bits of the piers, little bits of wharf and things like this that you can see sticking out of the mud sometimes or sticking out of the walls.
I think there's also an advantage sometimes, isn't there, if there are gaps in history or there are gaps to what you can see, in that because we're writing fiction, we can imagine them, you know, and we've always got the disclaimers. This is inspired by history.
Yeah.
And Strange Things by Sid Moore, published by Point Blank, will be out in June. Arrowood and The Meeting House Murders by Mick Finlay, published by HQ, will be out in July. And you can hear Mick Finlay talking in more detail about his work on an earlier Bookmark episode. To listen to that, go to our show page on cambridge105.co.uk.
And our guest on Bookmark today is Geoffrey Archer, talking about his new novel, Turn a Blind Eye, which is out this month. Geoffrey, your new novel, do you still get excited when your new novel comes out?
Oh, yes. I'm like a child unwrapping a present. And I got up at 4 o'clock this morning because I know the bestsellers list change on the day a book comes out. Press the button and it had gone straight to number one. Of course I was thrilled. And the first 5 reviews, can you believe it? These people have been reading since midnight. First 5 reviews made me feel yes. So the answer to your question is the day I stop getting excited, the day I'm not like a child opening a Christmas present, it's time to stop.
Well, yes, lots of accolades, lots of great reviews, massive sales, top of the bestseller lists. But I feel nervous about saying that. But obviously, you've never been on the Booker shortlist. You've never been on the Costa shortlist. How do you feel about that? Do you think there is a disconnect between critics for those prizes and what the public likes? What do you think about that?
That's a very fair question, and I've never heard it worded quite like that. I think if you do sell millions of copies, your chances of being recognized are not great. I've been awarded 2 awards in France as a writer, 1 in Germany, 1 in the United States, 1 in Ireland. I've never won anything in Great Britain. I think there is a degree of snobbery about being a storyteller. I don't mind. Thanks very much. As one Nobel Prize winner said to me at Trinity College quite recently, "Gore, wish I had your sales, Geoffrey." So I'm not complaining, but I was touched when Mr. Massey in The Scotsman said, "There are a lot of writers who wished they wrote as well as Geoffrey Archer, even before we discussed the storytelling." So I was touched by that. Someone actually came out and said, "What you're saying, in a way, is there a disconnect between selling millions of copies and being award prizes?" And if you said to me at the end of my days, "Would you rather have sold 275 million books or have the Nobel Prize?" I think I'll sell 275 million books.
And the storytelling that you're speaking about there, the stories that you tell, generally family sagas, crime-related, those are the areas you want to explore. Is that true? Those are the issues you like to explore on the page?
Well, I've had the courage occasionally to go in another direction because I wrote a book called Paths of Glory, which the critics were very flattering about. I took a real-life human being from Magdalen College, a man called George Mallory, who in 1924 decided he wanted to conquer Everest. And there he was in his 3-piece suit, rolled umbrella and hobnail boots. His body, of course, was discovered 700 foot from the summit. And we're not sure to this day whether he went up or was coming down. So I have occasionally broken away. And of course, the short stories are a breakaway. But the answer is yes. The family saga, Cain and Abel, the Clifton Chronicles, and now the William Warwicks, has been what the public have most liked. Yes, you're quite right.
And what is it about those that you like to explore? Why is it that you choose to, I know the public like them, but you need to enjoy writing them as well. What is it?
Well, I think every family has secrets. I think every family has a story to tell that no one will ever hear. And if you put that down, I mean, the first review this morning for Turn a Blind Eye said, it's like going back to old friends. Well, I guess that's the fun for me. William Warwick, his wife, Emma, who works in a distinguished art gallery, the wicked Miles Faulkner. I nearly was thinking of getting rid of him, and the readers kept saying, "We love Miles Faulkner." It's fascinating how they love the villains more than they love the heroes, but there you are. So yes, they're part of my family now. And if I'm allowed to live long enough, William, who starts life as a copper on the beat in London, and in book 2 becomes a detective sergeant, in book 3 a detective inspector, we will get him up to being commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. It'll be an 8-book series where he goes from a copper on the beat to being the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. I've written 5 of them. I've got to live another 3 or 4 years to get him to the... He's well capable of being commissioner. It's whether I'm capable of living to 87.
Oh, I think so. Well, let's see your second choice of music now, which is Chariots of Fire by Vangelis. Why this one?
No reason someone as young as you should remember, but I had the privilege of running for Great Britain and therefore have a sentimentality about athletics. And I think Chariots of Fire was one of the most wonderful athletics films. I knew Harold Abrams. I knew Lord Exeter. When I was a young student 60 years ago, 70 years ago at Oxford. So for me, they're real human beings. And I just think it's a lovely story. Of course, I went to see it with a friend of mine who was a far greater athlete than I was, Adrian Metcalf. And we realized they'd based the story on two Olympics, not one. But that was storytelling. So it's one of my favorite films. And I think the music is genuinely original.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
It's the breakfast show that's all about Cambridge. We've got the news.
National and local.
Travel updates.
From the A14 to Milton Road and all stations to Cambridge.
The people and the places.
Plus guests in our Friday food club.
Cambridge Juice.
All the new things to do in the city.
Our daily quiz.
Oh yes, questions with Lucian.
And all request Jukebox Friday.
And don't forget the coffee.
Cambridge Breakfast with Julian Clover and Lucy Milazzo.
Here with a fresh blend weekday mornings from 7.
What's in your spare room? Christmas decorations? Maybe an old exercise bike? Could you give that room to a young person along with a fresh start? St Christopher's Fellowship is looking for people to become foster carers in Cambridgeshire to provide safe, caring homes for teenagers who need help. And because we've been working to improve young people's lives since 1870, you can trust that you're not on your own. You'll receive regular training, dedicated social worker support, and space to share experiences with other carers. It's more than a spare room, it's a brighter future. Call 0800 234 6282 or visit stchris.org.uk/fostering. St Christopher's, creating brighter futures.
Hi, Pam here. Are you tired of the same old shops? Drop into Fantasia on Mill Road near Parker's Peace. Enter our treasure cave full of fine clothing and exotic homewares. Natural materials, uplifting ambiance, mood improvement guaranteed. Perk up your wardrobe, your home, your life. Dare to shop different. Fantasia, 64 Mill Road, Cambridge. Fantasia.uk.com.
For opening times, please see fantasia.uk.com.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
And our guest on Bookmark today is Geoffrey Archer, talking about his new novel, Turn a Blind Eye. Geoffrey, you've known in many roles, of course, as a writer and as a politician. Are there similarities between politics and writing?
Well, they're certainly storytellers, both of them, yes. I love my politics. It was a great privilege. I mean, biggest mistake in my life was going into the House of Commons at the age of 29. I was too young. I thought I was destined for great things and made a complete fool of myself. It'd be much better for young people, and I say it if anyone's listening, if you want to go into politics, 40 is the right age to go in. Sajid Javid came to see me as a young man and said, I want to go into the House of Commons. And I said, don't make the mistake I made, Sajid, don't go in young. And he very kindly took my advice and came into the House much later and, of course, became a cabinet minister and indeed Chancellor of the Exchequer. So what I'm getting at is I made a complete fool of myself. And then Margaret Thatcher kindly called me back to help run the election campaign and be in charge of the marginal seats. So I worked with Margaret Thatcher for 11 years, and then I worked for John Major for 7 years. So it was a great privilege to work for two prime ministers. And I loved every moment of it. But the answer to your question is, yes, they all get in the books in their own way. All this knowledge is good knowledge to have. Mixing with fascinating and interesting people can only get wonderful stories and strengthen a book. So everything I've done in my life, I think, wow, that's added to the ability to be a storyteller. And I'll give you an example. A lady came to see me quite recently and said, well, she said, Geoffrey, I want to write a book. And I said, fine. She said, yes, but I'm not like you. I don't know everybody. I haven't mixed with everybody. I haven't had all the privileges you've had. I said, where do you work? And she said, I work in a hairdresser. And I said, madam, you get more stories every day in a hairdresser than I will get in my lifetime. Now get on with it.
And you mentioned Margaret Thatcher there and John Major. What do you think of politics now? What do you think of the current Conservative?
Well, it's very different in the sense that when we were around, and certainly in my early years, there was no tweet. There was no Facebook. There was no social media. So they weren't being criticized every 10 minutes for the mistakes they were making. I think modern politicians, and not just modern politicians, young people, when I read these terrible stories about girls being attacked on tweet and on Facebook, I think what a terrible thing this is and what can we do about it? Because I never faced that when my mistakes were, they were made public, but I never faced 50,000 people giving their opinion on tweet in the next 30 seconds. I mean, I hate that, hate it. I was giving a speech in London quite recently, well, a year ago, to the Kit Kat Club. And this is a club you'll know about, of course, where you have to have become chairman or president. A woman has to have become chairman or managing director of her company by the age of 40. So I'm in the room with 150 feisty 30 to 40-year-old. I'm in heaven. And they're all beating me up. They're all giving me hell. And there was one woman in particular I thought was not only very beautiful, but incredibly bright. So I said, stop going for me. Go to the House of Commons and change the world. And she said, Geoffrey, I'm earning $250,000 a year. I currently have three lovers, and I don't really want to see their names on the front page of the Daily Mail. The sad aspect of that lady's comment was, how many good people are we losing for Great Britain Limited? Because they don't want that sort of publicity. Thank you very much.
Do you miss politics? I mean, would you go into it now, do you think, given what you said?
Wow, that's a good question. Wow. I can't answer that. I've never been asked that. I think I'm mad enough to say yes. I wanted to be prime minister. I failed. I wanted to be captain of the England cricket team. I failed. But the answer is yes, I think I'm stupid enough to have another go, yes.
And what do you think of the current incumbent?
Are you referring to the prime minister?
I am.
Well, I am puzzled. But clearly the British people like him. How can he be 10% ahead in the polls with the sort of publicity he gets? It's absolutely amazing. So you've got to give him credit. He's a great campaigner. You watch what's happening at the moment. He's in a different city every day. He's in a different hospital every day. He's masked up in his gown every day. He's a brilliant, brilliant campaigner. That's what he's brilliant at. The vaccine has been a massive success story. When we've had more people vaccinated than France, Germany, Italy, or Spain put together, and I think therefore he's been forgiven for possibly the fact that during the first 3 or 4 weeks of this pandemic, we didn't react quickly enough. I accept that. I'm married to a scientist, as you know. So every day I can discuss with Mary, who's chairman of the Science Museum, the scientific side and be well brought up to date.
Thank you, Geoffrey. Well, let's move away from dry land and into the sea with our next guest. Helen Scales is a marine biologist and writer. Her first book, Poseidon Steed, about seahorses, was published in 2010. Her second, Spirals in Time, about seashells, was a Radio 4 Book of the Week and chosen as a Book of the Year by The Times, The Guardian and The Economist. Her most recent book, The Brilliant Abyss, True Tales of Exploring the Deep Sea, Discovering Hidden Life and Selling the Seabed, came out last month. And when I met Helen, I started by asking her when her fascination with the sea began.
When I was a kid, I mean, I grew up, I was a real nature girl. I loved being outside. My family went to Cornwall a lot on holidays. But it was always when we went to the beach that I was most excited and I would most disappear off to explore rock pools and jump in the sea and look, put on some goggles and see what was down there. And then when I was 16, I learned to scuba dive and got to see wild fish for the first time and it completely hooked me in. I was just utterly mesmerized by being in their world and wanted to explore as much as I could and spend as much time underwater as I could from then on, really.
And when did you think this could be a career for you, something that you could follow for the rest of your life?
Again, it was in my teens, I suppose. I remember very vividly at school finding out from the careers office or something, the library or somewhere. I think I read about a course that was in environmental science. And I read this description about how you'd learn about the problems of the planet are facing. And I was a real eco kid at the time as well, like wanted to save the rainforest and that sort of stuff. The Amazon was busy being cut down at that point. And it really spoke to me. I suddenly thought, oh, here's a chance for me to really, it was just what I was interested in. So I could actually contribute to helping to save the planet. Then yes, please. And then, you know, the ocean swung into view when I learned to dive. And so saving the ocean became the sort of idea of, well, perhaps I could do a bit of that as well. Yeah.
And this book specifically about the deep sea, what do you mean by the deep sea?
So everything deeper than 200 metres down to the bottom, which is just shy of 11,000 metres. So a large, enormous, huge space, the biggest living space we have on the planet, about 95% of where things can live is the deep ocean. We take that 200 meters really because things have really started to change significantly in terms of what life can exist in the ocean when there's not much sunlight left, not enough to power plant life or algae to grow. So things are very different from that 200 meter mark downwards.
What is life like that deep in the ocean?
Well, it wasn't so long ago, maybe a sort of mid-19th, end of 19th century, when people generally thought nothing lived in the deep sea. It's far too cold. There's no sunlight. The pressure is enormous, you know, but they were wrong. And there is life all the way to the bottom of the very deepest seas. But life has found a way. And in fact, life might even have started in the deep sea. We're now thinking about theories that that's where we might have all started off. So life is very different. We find creatures that are made of delicate balls of jelly with tentacles and all sorts of glowing, glittering lights. Strange, strange fish with enormous mouths so that they can eat whatever comes along. You can't be fussy when you live in the deep sea. You pretty much have to shove anything you can find in your mouth. So basically everything we see in the deep is just strange and different to what we see on land. But then maybe that's to be expected because it is such a very different place to live. And there are all these different pressures and factors to consider when life is evolving down there.
And I've heard that as well as all that wonderful sea life, there's also plastic down there. Is that true, that the effects of man still can be found at that depth?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we might think of the ocean and the deep ocean particularly as being so remote and so vast that it's out of touch or beyond the reach of human impacts. But no, of course, that's not the case. And a lot of pollution and a lot of plastic ends up in the deep. I mean, plastics are everywhere now. That's the sad, sad truth. So, of course, they're in the deep. You know, a lot of it filters down. It trickles down to the bottom. What we don't yet know is what impacts that's having. But it certainly shows us that there is nowhere on this planet that humans haven't had an influence. And that's, I think, quite a profound thing to wrap your head around. There's plastic wrappers, you know, at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean. It's everywhere.
And how has man's relationship changed with the deep sea over time? Presumably there was a time where it was exploring. Are we still doing that or are we exploiting as well?
We're doing both. And I think we kind of always have, really. Those two things have gone together. The exploration, we want to know what's there. We've got this incredible curiosity about those unseen depths of the ocean. And we've always told great stories of monsters and, you know, imagined what might be down there. But at the same time, there are always also people thinking, oh, you know, what can we take and what's good for us to take from these depths of the ocean? And now that's still very much the case. Unfortunately, we're in this amazing golden era of discoveries. We've got amazing technologies to explore the deep in ways we haven't before. But also people asking questions like, well, oh, can the deep feed us? Can we harness the fish life down there? Can we go digging up minerals from the bottom of the sea that we could use for electric car batteries and things like that? Those questions are being asked more and more. And I think we need to think very carefully about whether we do want to open up the deep. It is the last vast frontier. It isn't properly, fully exploited yet. The question is, well, should we?
And I guess if we did, the knock-on impact of that, not just on that area, but on the rest of the seas would be obvious.
Well, that's it. I think as well, what we're learning is, well, you know, every time scientists go into the deep, we find new things. We're always discovering extraordinary new life forms that no one expected. But we're also uncovering how important the deep is and how it may be so far out of sight and out of mind, but there are connections through to our lives on land, through the air we breathe, the food we eat, the connections between shallow ecosystems and the deep. We're just seeing more and more how important the deep is. It harnesses carbon. Huge amounts of carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere is ending up in the deep sea. We've got the deep sea to thank for making climate change not quite as bad as it is already. The heat is going into the deep. So that all these reasons mean that if we start messing with the deep in ways we don't fully understand yet, all of those things could start to become disrupted and in ways, again, we don't fully understand. So perhaps we need to pause and think before we do those things, because there's so much at stake.
Are you optimistic about the future?
I think I have to be at least a little bit. I'm optimistic because I think a lot more people now are looking and thinking about the environment and the effects we're having and how important it is in so many ways. So I think now is the time to say, let's do things differently. So much in the world is changing so quickly, and we're seeing even through the pandemic how quickly things can change and how quickly progress can be made. I mean, just look at the vaccines we're having. Scientists can do things brilliantly quickly if they are given the resources and we have the incentive to do so. So why don't we do the same for our living planet as well? And I think we can make those big decisions to say, no, we don't do what we've just been doing for hundreds of years. Let's do it differently this time.
And you've written this amazing book on this area of the ocean. But if you had to pull out one fact about the deep to share with people, what would it be?
Oh, that's very tough. But I guess I'd have to underscore this idea of just how big and important the deep is. It makes up around 95 to 99% of the biome, the living space on our planet. We talk about the deep and we see weird creatures and we think, oh, they look like aliens. But they're earthlings. This is Earth. This is more of the living space of our planet than us creatures out on land. We're the weird ones. It's so enormous. Okay, here's one more quick fact, just to grasp the enormity of the deep for you. If you take a normal glass marble and sailed across to a piece of ocean above the very deepest parts, and if you drop that marble down, it would take 6.5 hours to reach the very bottom. That's how deep it is. Incredible.
What's the deepest you've been?
I haven't actually been that deep. I haven't been in a submersible. I would love to if the opportunity came on long, even though I'm a little bit claustrophobic, but I would probably get over that and climb inside a metal machine so I can go down and see what's down there. So I haven't done that. I've only been scuba diving down to about 40 meters, which is about as deep as I go. But I've been on expeditions where we're using remote robots, which is what a lot of scientists use these days. They send down these amazing machines and they see for us, you know, and there I was on the boat and this robot was 2,000 meters beneath my feet. And we're looking through in real time at what's down there, at the creatures swimming around below us. And that was pretty cool.
And The Brilliant Abyss by Helen Scales is published by Bloomsbury Sigma. And again, you can hear a longer chat with Helen Scales about her third book, Eye of the Shoal, on an earlier Bookmark episode by going to our show page on cambridge105.co.uk.
And our guest on Bookmark today is Geoffrey Arch, talking about his new novel, Turn a Blind Eye, which is published by Macmillan. So, Geoffrey, well, I was about to ask you what's next for you, but you've explained that you're going to carry on the William Warwick series. Is that what you're going to be concentrating on?
Yes, I'm 80 years old. I accept I can no longer captain the England cricket team. I accept I can no longer be Prime Minister. Turn a Blind Eye has gone straight to number one, so I'm not complaining. So thanks very much. I'll get on with writing, though I am looking forward to doing my charity auctions, which I love. That's my great hobby. That's the thing I've most missed, getting out stealing money from people who've made too much and giving it to charity. That's my hobby and I love it. I miss the theatre. I miss convenial chats to old friends. But we'll soon be out of that, but it won't stop me writing.
And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark, Geoffrey, what are you reading at the moment? What's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm doing a lot of research at the moment into fraud, so that's pretty boring, actually. But the best book I've read in the last couple of years is A Gentleman in Moscow. I thought it was a lovely piece of storytelling.
Thank you, Geoffrey. We'll hear your last choice of music in just a moment, but a heads up on our next show, our featured guest is Catherine Mennon, talking about her debut novel, Fragile Monsters. We'll hear from Janie Lee Grace on her book, Happy, Healthy, Sober, and Lucy Dillap talking about feminism's a global history. But we'll sign out now, Geoffrey, with your last choice of music, Spring by Vivaldi from The Four Seasons. Why this one?
I first heard it when I was at school. I can't pretend I've become a classical buff. I'm not. I loved it at 17, and I still love it at 80. Can I say any more?